From national news in D.C.
to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol,
this is your Capitol Connection.
And now, bringing the Capitol to you,
here's your host, Nate Groz.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is pushing for direct federal funding of abortion. Washington State wants to force churches to pay for abortion-inducing drugs and surgical abortion. And a new research report from George Barna reveals the 2020 election will be a battle not just of party platforms, but of diametrically opposed and competing worldviews. We'll talk about these issues and why the church can't be afraid to get into what the world calls political issues on this week's Capitol Connection. As always, we have the privilege of broadcasting from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln, and we have plenty to talk about on today's show, starting with the news that United States Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi will try to push for direct federal funding of abortions next year. According to breaking reports last week, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and House Democrats are expected to push for direct federal funding of abortions next year, paid for out of the pockets of taxpayers. This move would end the Hyde Amendment, which has been attached to federal appropriations bills every year since 1976. The Hyde Amendment prevents federal tax dollars from funding abortion. The LA Times reported that beginning next year, Democratic leaders in the House will no longer back that annual amendment to put the prohibition into law. They've told a small group of House Democrats announced by Speaker Pelosi that the days of their party supporting the Hyde Amendment are done. The Hyde Amendment specifies that Medicaid will not pay for an abortion unless the woman's life is in danger or the pregnancy resulted from rape or incest. The article from the LA Times that broke this story references the, quote, dramatic and widespread reversal that Democrats have recently undergone over the last 5 years on the issue of abortion. And in fact, even Democrat presidential candidate Joe Biden also recently reversed his long-held support for the Hyde Amendment. He switched his position after initially and for decades supporting the Hyde Amendment to prevent federal tax dollars from funding abortion, and now supports federal taxpayer funding of abortion. The LA Times notes that what was once viewed as an acceptable compromise is now widely seen among Democrats as a prime example of systemic racism. And this is, of course, not only untrue, but also incredibly ironic, given the fact that Planned Parenthood, our nation's largest abortion provider, was in fact founded by a racist, Margaret Sanger, who believed that abortion was a form of eugenics and pushed it in minority communities in order to reduce and eliminate minority populations. Mallory Quigley, a spokeswoman for the pro-life Susan B. Anthony list, told the LA Times that this is a terribly reckless push on the part of Democrats to force taxpayers to fund abortion on demand. People don't want to be complicit in abortion with their taxpayer dollars, regardless of how they identify, pro-life or pro-choice. And while this is a hotly debated issue, this isn't just some mundane policy decision. Since the enactment of the Hyde Amendment, an estimated 60,000 preborn babies have been saved from abortion every year since 1976. If consistent for the last 44 years, this means the Hyde Amendment has saved an estimated 2,640,000 preborn babies from abortion. This is a big deal, and hopefully something that people are paying attention to. This is a major shift. If the House of Representatives is controlled by the Democrats next year like it is currently, then this move stands a chance of passing. Of course, however, whatever bill the House passes, if they pass a bill without the Hyde Amendment, it would still have to go through the Senate, where 60 votes are needed to move forward for any legislation. And now, obviously, this sets up a major election issue. For reference, a 2016 poll by YouGov found that 55% of Americans support the Hyde Amendment's prohibition on direct federal funding of abortions with taxpayer dollars. But if Speaker Pelosi gets her way, the United States federal government could take money out of the pockets of hardworking Americans and use that money to directly pay for abortions because of racism. which is just absurd and quite frankly offensive. It should be unconscionable to begin with to think that your money, your tax dollars, would be used by your own government to end the lives of innocent preborn children in the womb. But to justify that decision because of racism is utterly baseless. And not only baseless, but completely contrary to the truth about abortion, which is that it disproportionately affects low-income and minority communities. It's wrong, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. But sadly, Speaker Pelosi isn't the only one making a push for this. In fact, Washington State wants to force churches to pay for abortions, and they want them to pay for not only coverage and health insurance plans for contraceptives and abortion-inducing drugs, but for surgical abortion procedures. And morally, whether it's through a medication abortion or surgically, every abortion ends the life of an innocent human being. But this is going beyond even, you know, the Obama contraception mandate to try to directly force churches to pay for surgical abortions. And people, especially opponents of religious freedom, love to use the phrase separation of church and state as a battle cry to remove prayer from public schools, to erase historical religious landmarks, and even block people of faith from serving in public office. But meanwhile, like here, we are seeing real violations of separation of church and state. Across the country, we're seeing numerous incidents in which the government is trying to control what churches teach, where they worship, and how they exercise their religious freedom. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit this past spring, some government officials put the First Amendment on hold and treated churches worse than secular businesses, allowing bars and liquor stores and casinos, theme parks, and of course, abortion clinics to operate while churches were shuttered and forced to close their doors. But going back to even before the pandemic hit, Cedar Park Assembly of God in Washington State faced a harrowing threat to their religious freedom when the state of Washington enacted a law that forces churches to pay for abortions, including surgical abortions, through their health insurance plans. And Cedar Park Church, like many churches, believes and teaches that every human life, whether born or unborn, is valuable, precious, and worthy of protection. But rather than respecting Cedar Park and other churches' freedom to exercise their own religious beliefs, the state of Washington has gone out of its way to try to force churches to pay for abortions. The Washington State Senate passed a bill, the so-called Reproductive Parity Act, and the act mandates that healthcare plans in the state that offer maternity care must also pay for elective abortions. So a healthcare plan in the state of Washington, if you are going to provide maternity care, you must also pay for elective abortions. And as a result, Cedar Park's, this church's health insurer, put surgical abortion coverage directly into the church's health plan. This means that when the church provides its more than 180 employees and their families with quality and affordable health insurance, they have to fund abortion. And failure to do so could mean fines, including criminal penalties, which includes jail time. Thankfully, this is a church that knew that their rights were being violated and they weren't going to allow this to happen or participate in this. And so a lawsuit was filed on their behalf against the state of Washington. And currently, that case is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And they are doing so because all churches should have the freedom to practice their beliefs without being severely punished by their own government. And again, when we hear people invoking that phrase, separation of church and state, it often just means that they want to shut believers and Christians out of the public square. That's really what it comes down to. That's why it's used. It's been weaponized against people of faith. But of course, that phrase, its original intent and usage meant the exact opposite. It was meant to protect churches' religious freedom and ensure that the federal government wasn't telling churches what to do and what to believe. And so when the founders drafted the First Amendment, they were more concerned with protecting believers from the government and not the other way around. And that's incredibly clear. It's amazing how much that has been twisted to fit into an anti-religious freedom narrative. And so in this case, the state of Washington is violating this separation by trying to improve its pro-abortion views onto churches by requiring them to pay for abortions. And this unquestionably is a violation of churches' First Amendment freedoms. The bottom line, churches should be free to operate according to their faith without being threatened by the government. So with both of these stories, this is a great example of what's happening. What we have is competing worldviews. We have people in federal government who believe abortion is a human right that should be celebrated, and that taxpayers should have to pay to fund abortions whether they want to or not. And we have state governments forcing churches to pay for abortion whether they want to or not. And then you have people and churches on the other side with a different worldview who believe that every single life, born and unborn, is a precious gift created in the image of God that should be cherished and protected, and to participate or fund abortions in any way is morally wrong. And what we are this is just continuing to grow, and it's obviously coming to a head with the election in November. And George Barna, who is one of the most respected pollsters in the nation on subjects involving Christianity, recently released some new data, a new analysis on worldviews in the United States. And his latest analysis takes on these differing worldviews as they affect political leanings. And George Barna puts a special emphasis on what he calls integrated disciples, or people with a true biblical worldview and what they believe compared to other worldviews. And just because a survey respondent may think or say that they possess a biblical worldview doesn't factor in to Barna's methodology. In fact, he doesn't even ask that question, but what he does do is pose a series of belief and action questions that sort out whether a person actually believes and lives according to a biblical worldview. So, for example, 7 out of 10 Americans say they are Christians when asked by pollsters. But Barna's results, however, indicate that only 6% actually hold a biblical worldview. Those integrated disciples, according to Barna, tend to hold conservative political views in greater numbers than adults without a biblical worldview. For example, they pay more attention to political news than those without a biblical worldview. They believe in the definition of marriage as one man and one woman, and are more deeply committed to practicing their religious faith. Those with a biblical worldview are more conservative in their fiscal views, much more likely to prefer capitalism to socialism, and prefer smaller government in much greater numbers than those without a biblical worldview. So what does this all mean, especially as it comes into play for the 2020 elections? Barna concludes that politics is no longer just about party platforms, but competing worldviews. He says, quote, "The raging political wars in America, with the population seemingly irreconcilably divided, is not really the result of the divergent political platforms of the leading parties or differing opinions of the candidates, as much as it is about the worldview differences that separate factions within our country." He writes that, in fact, recent battles over how to respond to the coronavirus and the urban lawlessness triggered by the indefensible murder of George Floyd are primarily outgrowths of conflicting worldviews. One of the important implications of a worldview is that people do what they believe. Barna goes on to state that over the past 40 years, Americans have been gradually but consistently abandoning a range of foundational biblical beliefs in favor of a human-centric, consensual, emotion-driven understanding of and response to the world. That transition has been highly visible in relation to morality and political preferences. According to Barna, this gradual shift in worldview has shown up less in previous elections because moderates have been less politically active. But he says, come November 3rd, we will know which worldview has won the hearts of Americans and will then determine the foundation for the nation's values, lifestyles, and public policy for the near future. And you might be thinking, the church's role should not be in politics or to speak to controversial issues or political issues. But our friends over at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, with their What Would You Say video series, have an excellent video on this very question: should churches get involved with political issues? And they draw out some really important points to remember.
You're in a conversation about religion and politics, and someone says, churches shouldn't get involved in political issues. What would you say? Politics can be dirty, but the church should be holy. So a lot of people believe that churches should avoid political issues. Sometimes the intention is to help the church avoid compromising situations. Other times, this is said in an attempt to keep the church out of the public square. But is it biblical? The next time you hear someone say that churches should avoid political issues, here are three things to remember. First, there's no such thing as a political issue. There are economic issues, environmental issues, criminal justice issues, educational issues, and transportation issues. But there are no political issues. Why? Because politics is not a category of issues. Politics is a process. The political process can be used to work through any issue as we attempt to order our lives together. What side of the road should we drive on? What's the definition of marriage? The fact that an issue is being debated in a political process should not determine whether Christians should care about it. Which leads to the second point. Second, if God cares about an issue, we should care about it too. The Bible doesn't speak to which side of the road we should drive on, but it does have a lot to say about marriage and the value of each life. For Christians, the critical question is not, is this political or not, but does God care? When He cares, we should care. That's what we signed up for. Besides, churches that claim to avoid political issues rarely do so consistently. Many avoid cultural hot potatoes like homosexuality or the definition of marriage, but speak loudly on issues like racial injustice and human trafficking, as they should. God cares about them all. But selective engagement suggests that our real concern is not about political involvement, but about offending cultural sensitivities. Which leads to the third point. Third, the choice to avoid political issues is itself a political decision. When churches selectively decide which biblical issues they will speak about based on expected reactions, they're doing the most political thing possible. They're telling people what they want to hear, not what they need to hear. Churches don't represent themselves. They represent Jesus. We shouldn't speak or engage because we're angry, and we should never be unkind. But avoiding conflict is not the example Jesus gave. Let's review. Next time someone tells you churches shouldn't get involved in political issues, remember, there's no such thing as a political issue. Politics is simply a process. Second, if God cares, we should care. That's what it means to be a Christian. And third, avoiding political issues is a political decision. Doing what is popular is political. Doing what is right is biblical.
The critical question is not, is this political, but does God care? You know, the other thing that I think is so important to remember, especially in times like we're living in right now, is that Christians must not be afraid of being controversial. Recently, Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, pointed out that we often avoid controversy because we associate controversy with things that are wrong. But if you read the New Testament, controversy surrounded Jesus. Controversy surrounded his disciples. Controversy was a way of life for those who follow Jesus. And Tony is right in his call for Christians to take a stand on issues that may be perceived as controversial is very needed in our country right now. Because as Christians, we know that nothing is new under the sun. And although our beliefs are routinely labeled as too controversial or old-fashioned or even extreme, we know that we are called to stand for truth in the public square. And of course, this doesn't mean that we should be rude or angry. We should always be kind and bear witness to the truth and to the gospel with grace and speak kindly towards others and compassionately. But that does not mean that we should back down or shy away from the issues that are important to God and that the Bible speaks on clearly just because the world or people around us might consider it controversial. The term controversial comes from the Latin root controversia, which when broken down, the word is a combination of contra, which means turning in an opposite direction, and versus, turn toward or against. In other words, to be controversial is to intentionally turn in the opposite direction of one thing and turn towards another. And what we can't forget is that being controversial is not always a bad thing. Especially for Christians, we are called to stand counter to the ways of the world and turn towards truth. In fact, if believers in the church aren't considered controversial by the world, then there's probably something wrong. Because to be controversial means to be countercultural. Christ didn't call his disciples to conform to the world, but to be transformed. And moreover, Jesus warned his disciples that taking a stand for truth would bring about judgment from the world. 1 John chapter 3, verse 13 says, "If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you." And the same truth applies to Christians today. This is not to say that Christians should intentionally incite controversy or scornfully dismiss those who disagree with us. Of course not. But what it does mean is that we as Christians, when we face opposition or are in a situation where standing for truth is frowned upon or considered controversial, we still need to take a stand. And we should not just go along silently with destructive thoughts and ideas or institutions that subvert the truth. And as the Family Research Council further points out, truth is expensive. When we intentionally choose to stand for truth, it's going to cost us something. It might cost us relationships, might cost us jobs, or even our lives as Christians being persecuted by authoritarian regimes around the world can attest to. So, in a world of opposition that seeks to make its own truth and abandon morality, Christians must remember that we should turn away from worldly ways and instead turn towards the way, the truth, and the life. And inevitably, this means we will be controversial. But we can take heart because Jesus was the most controversial person to ever live. To stay up to date on the latest news impacting family, freedom, and life, and to learn how you can partner with Nebraska Family Alliance to defend life, religious freedom, and family values, visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. That's all the time we have for this week. I'm your host, Nate Graz, Policy Director for the Nebraska Family Alliance. Hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.